cliffcentral.com.
I felt like I needed to reconnect with someone who, he's a bit of a Renaissance man when it comes to the things that he's interested in, the things that he's written about over the years. And that's not saying too much, because, in fact, it might even be saying too little, because Dennis Beckett's one of those people who really does have such varied interests. He does have such an incredible general knowledge of the world and a very specific knowledge of certain things. If you've read any of his stuff, whether it's books, columns, whether you've seen him on television or you've heard him on radio, Dennis Beckett is one of those people, seems to just get it. He he can start a conversation about just about anything, and by the end of it, he will have learned something, but more especially, you will have seen how much he actually does know already, and he might just be testing you so that you can get the best out.
I think I'm going to have to get you to put all this in writing, Gareth. I don't know that anybody says such polite things about me in real life.
It's really nice to see you again.
And also, I love this thing, Renaissance. Renaissance, man, that sounds really ancient.
Don't you know? But, well, it means you're very, very old. No, it means that you do. You have all these interests. You're one of those people, those rare people who are curious about the world, which always to me is the mark of intelligence.
I don't know how rare that is. There's curiosity about the world all over the place. I'll concede. I'll admit to curiosity. I am curious. I like to know what's happening. I like to know how people can live together.
There are lots of people who are willfully ignorant. They just decide, well, that's not something I'm that curious about. I'll move on.
Perhaps.
It's never diminished with you.
Curiosity is still there, absolutely.
So what in the last couple of years, because we met when I was a very average producer. In fact, I remember you coming in, and yours was one of the shows I did enjoy producing, because you'd arrive and you'd say, I want to talk about this and that. What suggestions do you have? I'd say one or two things. You'd go, perfect, let's go. Maybe you'd have a guest every now and then, but I didn't have to work. Like when John Robbie would come in the mornings and I was producing for him, it was the most horrible job I ever had, because he was a very tough taskmaster, but he was also... he was very particular about what he wanted. You could talk about anything, and if I put a guest in front of you, you'd extract all the good stuff out of them in half an hour to an hour, and it would be fascinating, and I would almost feel like a passenger on the flight.
That's quite a fascinating memory. I hadn't kind of perceived that or any of that that you say. Well, how about that? That was, what are we talking about?
That's
are we talking 20 years ago?
Easily. Yeah. 20 years ago. Mm. You remember Beckett's Trek? Now, if you didn't see this show, this was pretty fascinating too, because you would tour South Africa. You did everything from going to rave clubs.
Not only South Africa, we went abroad as well.
You went to rave clubs. You met with important people, politicians, decision makers, CEOs,
presidents,
kings. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Was that your idea? The entire thing?
The funny thing about that was that there had been a program called Face the Facts. Mm-hmm. The Facts was kind of new at the time. And some bright guy at the SABC had thought of the idea that you would do an economic program where people would fax in questions, which would then arrive on screen, and you'd take them off the fax, and you'd read out the question, and the Face the Facts operator would present the question to his guest, who would be like the Minister of Finance or an economist or a CEO or something. And the chap who was doing this didn't like doing it. He'd been a recently appointed economics editor, and he found that this thing at 10 o'clock on Tuesday night was getting on his head. And one day he phoned me on a Tuesday morning, and he said, would I do his program for him tonight? I said, I know nothing about economics, Johnny. He says, that's okay, just get the goddamn faxes. And they also supplement this, because people could phone and then the staff themselves would send the fax through, so that it looked like the fax was in much operation. And I thought, well, I can read questions on faxes and I can ask. It was Chris Liebenberg, was Minister of Finance at the time.
Wow.
I thought, okay, let's do it. And then
you have
that
to be quite fearless
while.
To do that.
Not necessarily. I said to Chris, you'll accept that I'm genuinely representative of the average listener, and for that matter, the average citizen. I know not the faintest thing about economics. Chris says, that's fine. He then started to explain to me what's the difference between the debt and the deficit.
Oh, wow. And,
but then some guy a little while later decided that this was elitist, because it implied that people had to have faxes to be listening. So they cancelled it, and they cancelled it on half a day's notice.
Mm-hmm.
because I got a message on my answering machine saying you don't need to come today. So I phoned the general manager and I say, well, look, that's okay, fine, but it's a bit abrupt. You know, I get an anonymous message from somebody I don't even know saying your program's canned. Oh, I beg your pardon. I should have said that after that first episode, well, it just wore in. So I did lots more episodes. Yeah. And then a guy said, well, we've got to do something on Tuesday nights now. Have you got an idea? So I said, why don't you have some guy wandering around the countryside a little bit asking snotty questions? And I said, let's do it. So that was a bit, it was a bit kind of unfair. There was a whole reasonable long list of people who'd been earnestly battling to get airspace on SABC. In those days, of course, that was it. It was SABC.
And it was hard to get on the SABC because they were very particular.
So I snuck in for this weird, odd reason, and I don't know, there was no procedure, no process, no cross-examination, no qualification. I just, on a Tuesday, I didn't even phone him that Tuesday. It was a Wednesday morning. And he said, well, when do you start? So I said, when do you need? So I said, when we need something for next Tuesday night. So we started the program then and there.
Now, you mentioned cross-examination because actually your background was in law.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you were admitted to the bar and everything else. But you,
hey, how do you remember that? Maybe you've been reading something sneaky.
But you very quickly decided that there were other more exciting things going on.
That's right.
Isn't it interesting how many people go into law and then decide that's not for them?
Well, I suppose it applies to lots of... For me, one factor is that, to me, getting around the world, getting to places, saying what happens here, that's inherently interesting. Wrestling over the interpretation of statutes is not inherently exciting. And the much larger, bigger feature in my mind is that I want to come to my own conclusions.
Yeah.
I don't want, if you are suing Sia over here, and I actually, and you take me on, and I actually secretly prefer his case to yours, I want to be able to say I'd rather that he wins. And you can't do that.
No,
you
got to take whatever comes to you.
That's
right.
Right, yeah.
So journalism wasn't something that was on the agenda until it happened.
No, always been. I'd always been.
Really?
In fact, yeah. Okay, there'd been a thing. I don't think you were even born, actually, at this time. But I was in, there was a march in 1969 that became sort of famous because it was illegal and there was all issues about it and because the cops ended up breaking lots of people's heads. And the person who later became my wife and I were part of this march. And after the march, and there were several hundred or thousand people involved in this, after the march, like 15 people got prosecuted. And I became one of those. I was one of those people because I'd written a defense of the march in the Rand Daily Mail, which was then the place to be.
Mm.
And, I mean, okay, there'd always been, like, writing had been somewhere in my head. And so that was my first bit of journalism. That was, like, quite an interesting way to be thrust into journalism, to write an article then in the Rand Daily Mail, which was absolutely at the center. The article was at the center of what all the issues were all about.
And it was experiential, and at the same time, it was almost an everyman's take on it, because you weren't you weren't in editorial management at that stage.
No, I was a student at that stage. But then the Rand Daily Mail had been quite critical. They'd said, look, these stupid students have got to behave better because they're damaging the cause and so forth. And I said, no, this is why we've done it. So it was a defense as well.
So you're a bit of an activist as well, huh?
I wasn't a particular activist. That was, I was on the fringes. I wasn't in any major league, any activist.
You say your wife was on the march with you?
Yep. And we sat down together. We were holding hands when the cops came. And one of the guys who knew said, sit down. It's much harder for them to break your heads if you're seated. So we all sat down. And to this day, I remember holding my wife's hand as we waited for the cops to come and smack us. And actually, they didn't do any
What a romantic
damage.
Story.
No, it was lovely.
I mean, you did go into taking control of some of the editorial directions of some of these papers. I mean, The Star, and you mentioned Rand Daily Mail, and The World.
Yes, World. Right? World. Yeah. World was what is now The Sowetan was then World. It later became Post for a while, and then it's The Sowetan. It was banned as The World on October the 19th, 1977, at which stage I was, quote, a senior assistant editor, unquote, of Weekend World, which actually meant that I produced two papers a week. I call it two for the moment. I produced a Saturday paper and a Sunday paper. I was de facto editor of two papers. And that was, I must say, that was a hell of a fun period. It was a fun and interesting and in some ways a frightening period.
You know, the world's changed so much now that if you think about a newspaper and what it took to publish two papers a week, that's a lot of reading. That's a lot of information. These days we refer to it as content management, right? And digital content and all this stuff. But in those days it meant someone had to actually type something up on a typewriter or even write it down in their own handwriting, give it to you as an editor. You had to read through it, decide whether or not it fits in, make the corrections or delete parts of it that you thought were not necessary, add some stuff in.
Not much has changed, China. That still happens. The industry is no longer what it was. It's a shadow of what it was because, of course, the broader, the amorphous, in other words, immeasurable, you can't actually define or identify it. But the spread of social media, the spread of media opportunities has changed the print industry.
Yeah.
But whether you're in print or whether you're in on screen, you still want words. You still want words put into order.
But you're someone who can help me deal with this idea of fake news. And you're someone who can help me understand.
Jeez, I don't understand.
No, but credibility then. Let's talk about credibility. Because if you had run a bullshit story in those days as the editor, there would have been massive repercussions.
There were massive repercussions even when you didn't. And in fact, I remember the day that just before the world got banned, there were huge repercussions. There was one particular day, Percy Khoboza. Hell, you know, I can so often get that so right. Vachabiki.
Khoboza.
He's doing it better than me. That makes me really cross. Normally I get it right, not this time.
That's all right.
Anyway, Percy had been on a Friday night. Percy and I had issues because I'd started doing leaders in the Saturday paper. Uh-huh. And Percy, he mumbled about my leaders. He wanted my leaders to be more fierce. And so Percy goes off on a Friday. He doesn't tell me. He goes, John Forster, the Prime Minister, summons Percy. Percy gets going, and he comes back quite late that evening, just when I've put the Saturday paper to bed.
And he's been to the President.
He's been to the Prime Minister.
Who was
the Chief Executive at that stage.
Yes.
The President was then a nominal
figurehead.
Guy. And Forster was quite a terrifying character.
Yes.
And Forster had actually shat Percy out from the very dizzy height. And this meeting later became quite a public thing. But when Percy came back on the Friday evening, I knew is that he was pretty nervous and he was saying, oh, you know, we're heading for trouble here. And
because people just disappeared at that time.
That's a different issue. Don't exaggerate.
Certainly it was dangerous.
Don't exaggerate the ills. Yeah. There were many ills, but we now get into a habit of making everything one massive, overwhelming ill. We were never a totalitarian state. There's never been a totalitarian country on the soil. Eh?
Okay.
And that includes the apartheid era. It was authoritarian, yes, bad news, but it wasn't totalitarian.
All right. Good distinction.
Now, so Percy gets back. Forster's been telling him, listen, watch it. You better behave yourself or else. Meantime, I, sitting back in Industria, I've been thinking, I'm going to make Percy happy today. I'm going to produce a really fierce leader. So the paper's gone now. The trucks are actually rolling out of the premises even as we speak, carrying this really fierce leader across the lengths and breadths of the Transvaal. Tomorrow morning, Forster's going to read it and he's going to think, geez, look at this guy. He walks out of my office and this is what he writes. Because Percy was editor, he's the guy who carries the can for the leader.
Sure.
Oh, well, they were frightening times. How did we get onto that?
But how did that work out then? Because he got back and you had to show him what you'd produced.
Yeah. He sees the finished product.
Did he go home crying?
No.
Did you go and drink?
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
That's
precisely
drink.
Right. We actually had a pub upstairs. We had a general manager, a guy named John Marquardt, one of the great two tragedies. Percy died young. Yeah? He died on his 50th birthday.
Well, because of what you put him through.
No, sorry. Even Percy wouldn't exactly blame me for that. He'd blame me for a few other things.
Yeah.
But Percy died young and John Marquardt died young. And they both, well, John had left. He'd gone to Australia. To me, that was just a pity. It was one of those. He was a guy who never was meant to be leaving here.
When people who go to Australia, they almost die. I mean, you know, in a way.
What he was doing is, in effect, he was saying, I declare I declare no faith in South Africa. And this is a guy, I mean, his family had been in this country. They left their name on a dorpie in the Vrystaat, and his uncle had been the king of education. He'd been the guy who'd spread education across South Africa, in particularly black education, by the way. And I just didn't need to go. Anyway, then he died, and it was a tragedy to me.
You know, when I have the opportunity to talk to people who've seen as much change and who've been in the role of having to explain that to an audience as you have, I like to cast a sort of long view of history. And often I find it quite comforting that the people who have that long view of history and who've been in the job of interpreting real world events and helping other people who read or watch or listen to understand them, it gives me comfort because sometimes their perception of what we understand to be a massive, tragic, critical, dangerous situation, they see it sometimes as being just part of that wheel of fortune, just part of that story of history unraveling, just another chapter in a quite long book, and not necessarily the climactic one or the worst one. How do you feel right now?
To me, the wheel of history keeps on rolling, and it actually refines. It goes a little bit higher. It gets a little higher up the road all the time. Everybody's griping and groaning now for all the obvious reasons. I do feel that there's certain mistakes here. I think that there's an absolute over-blaming of Zuma. Zuma might have been up to all sorts of no good. How do we to understand this Gupta stuff, etc.? I don't know. But it's not only him. For me, the spread of corruption has been, I mean, we're learning now quite how much of it there has been, and I think there's a lot more learning to come up on that subject. But it's much greater than, it permeates in a way we now have to recognize that we didn't necessarily think. I thought for a while it was some corrupt people within a reasonable hole, and I discovered that the civil service and so forth, and everybody's got their own inner stories about how the spread of it now. It's wrong, it's bad, and it's not tragic. We are going to get beyond this one. It is a lot easier getting beyond this one than getting beyond our last big hurdle. Getting past apartheid, we had to get past apartheid. We were never going to be a stable society until we were not arguing any longer about who was what level of citizenship. That had to be done.
Right.
We now have to make, having gotten, you know, the old, well, maybe not, and it can get awfully boring, but in like a sentence, Hegel wrote this thing called the theory of the dialectic that Marx then sort of borrowed, and making it in extremely vulgar terms, the point is when you've been making a mistake for a long time and you switch, you'll make the opposite mistake for a while. In many ways, we're making the opposite mistake now, and then you'll move to the next point. You'll go from thesis to antithesis, and then you come to synthesis, and then that will become the new thesis of a higher level of turning around later to come. We're on that process.
That's what I wanted. I just wanted you to say that because that's the perspective. We get caught up in the immediate stuff, right? And even when you're a journalist, you do. You everybody's focused right now on Cyril and Nkosazana, and is there going to be a recall this weekend? And you know, in 2 weeks' time, we may have forgotten all the things that today are keeping us so busy.
I would venture to suggest that whoever becomes president in a few years, we'll be saying, get this guy or person out of there. This is a sad thing about a country. When you're anointing new messiahs and then kicking them out and degrading them, and they're discredited. That's sort of sad, and we're in that mold. I mean, we kicked out Thabo, now we're kicking out Zuma, now the next one is probably going to go as well. Your messiah switches to your scapegoat. Yeah. You don't want that. You don't want messiahs in the first place. You want ordinary reason. Talk about decent politics. Talk about decent politics. Decent politics is to come.
You think so?
Yes, to come. And I'll also tell you, and I'm not going to bog you down with this now, what I'm doing now is I spent a hell of a lot of time. In fact, I worked out the other day, it probably comes to the equivalent of 18 years over 33 years.
Right.
trying to argue the case that you can make decent politics anywhere, anytime. Now, of course, it sounds utterly implausible to you as I say it here in a sentence, not even a sentence, a phrase, but Vachabiki, because that one's coming up.
Is there a roadmap to this? How do you make decent politicians? We were talking about them this morning, saying most of them are crooks.
You can say, if there's the so-called magic bullet or what, silver bullet, whatever you say, I'm saying we have all along wasted the greatest, not only us as a country, the whole world has actually wasted the greatest stabilizing force in existence, which is the force of the ordinary people who aren't interested in politics. I'm saying figure out how to mobilize that force, how to get Mama Chabalala, who doesn't like the ANC, she doesn't like the DA. The DA is other people's party in any case, and all these politicians make her scared and nervous. And she doesn't want to go to the polls because who knows who's watching you going, and he thinks that you look like an opposition voter and you're going to be in trouble. You just want her to have reasonable grounds and reason and ease to be able to express things that she wants. She doesn't necessarily want socialism or capitalism. She wants the dustbins to be clean, to be cleared on Thursday afternoon. Yeah. And when she's got the capacity to say that through the political system, you have a degree of stabilization like you have never seen before. Never thought
it's
of.
The wisdom of the silent majority.
Not wisdom. It's not. Yes. Okay. Use wisdom. But then people say, okay, you're assuming that human nature is good or wise or whatever. I don't necessarily assume that individuals are wise or good.
But
or
you
anything.
Can't have. You studied law.
That's a nice one. But I do say that if you provide the proper political system, you make stable politics no matter what your population is. You could have a totally illiterate population and you would still have a stable society. I don't believe it,
but I hope.
Yeah, I hope you'll see that one as well.
Listen, I defer to your experience and I defer to your better knowledge of human nature.
I don't know that there's such a thing.
Let me ask you a selfish sort of media type question. Because you've done it all. You've done a bit of TV, you've done a bit of radio, you've done print, you've done online. You've done it all. Magazines, books, you know.
Yeah.
Which of these things excites you the most? Which of these things turns you on the most?
Look,
what's the most fun
part? This is almost a bit of a confession. But I have a secret love affair with print. Print, and particularly long print, as opposed to rushed print.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly long print, you have the opportunity and the challenge to say it exactly right. As we're chatting now, it's nice, it's great, it's fun. If we were to put what we're saying into print, it'd look undisciplined and indulgent, and it'd feel all wrong. And the opportunity that print gives you of refining what you're saying, of making you think through what you're saying. An Irish writer named Flannery O'Connor said a beautiful thing. I write to know what I think. And writing makes you know what you think. Writing takes you to new places that you didn't think at the time that you started doing the writing.
I'm going to have to disagree with you. I aver that a lot of long-form journalism has been replaced by exactly what we're doing now.
Yeah.
Is it a ver or aver? I
won't actually fight you on that. I've just always assumed a ver, but I'm also to be corrected.
Well, we'll fight. Okay. So I would say that this form of conversation, which other people can be a part of now, which can happen even if it's for a very small audience or if it's a very big audience, depending on how interesting it is to people, but this kind of conversation where we could sit and talk without interruptions.
Yes.
And where you have tone of voice.
Yes.
Where you have.
Yes.
You can inject some personality, some character into it. You can throw in a little one-liner that comes out of nowhere. They can almost hear your thought processes.
I'm with you.
This is somehow a lot more intimate and real. I understand that you make a very good case for writing to distill, to perfect and to craft. That I don't disagree with.
I'm not saying writing is better than talking. I'm saying writing is different. I'm saying my particular love is that compulsion to work through. And by the way, I frequently don't succeed. But the push to work through it, to make your point so that it's comprehensible and going exactly where you want it to be. What we're doing is, there's no question whatever, it's a stupendously valid process. It's in a different direction. They have different strengths, the different media.
Speaking of strengths, you've got this ability to, and I remember this from years ago and everything that you've done since, but you've got this ability, you've got this formidable intelligence, but you've got a very approachable, friendly, everyman way of dealing with people. Do you think that
in respect of the formidable intelligence, I must worry about your eyesight slightly.
No, come on.
In respect of the approachability,
this is false humility. You know,
my dad was Irish. My dad was Irish, and he brought me various things from Ireland. One was a taste for Guinness. One was he believed that everybody was his friend. Everybody was his friend. We'd walk in the morning, and everybody was his friend. And that was long before that was the fashion. You were meant to have your long white nose pointing upward. And he also brought me a taste for cold showers. It's slightly irrelevant, but I still to this day
have a cold shower this morning?
Yep, I have a cold shower every morning. I of course have a hot shower. I don't walk in and get into the cold shower. I have the hot shower, and I love the hot shower. And then when the hot shower's over, I love turning on, and I make it fast. So I immediately turn off the hot and maximize the cold. And that's a lovely feeling that hits you. Thwack.
With all the respect in the world, that sounds insane.
Try it someday. You'll change your mind.
I think of what is invigorating.
But what you must do before you try it, before you have your cold, you must turn up the hot so that it's just about too painful to bear. And then you zap off the hot and you zap on the cold, and that's the most magnificent feeling.
For how long?
Well, if you're in Cape Town, about 2 seconds
20,
before you run 20, out.
30, I don't know.
Okay. Really? So this is your thing every morning?
Yeah.
And it invigorates you. You feel good afterwards.
Yeah.
Jeez. All right. Well, we all have our punishments. You're a bit of a sadomasochist thing there, guy. Yeah. But go back to the question. So you inherit from your dad this ability to imagine that everyone is your friend. When you meet someone, there's goodwill. Is this where it comes from? I'm trying to figure out why you're able to do something that few people can do. You could approach anybody, any social stratum, any philosophy, ideology, point of view, and you go in without judgment. I've seen you do this. It's part of why you were good at interviewing people.
Well, I don't know. I don't know what the question is. I would like to think.
Do you think it's a natural?
I don't think there's
it's a natural thing,
there.
Or do you think it's something learned?
No, I don't know. I suppose it's natural. I'm not sure. I don't believe, unless there's some really powerful reason to perceive a person in who you are meeting who is there. Unless there's some good reason to see them as some kind of enemy, they're not. And how often is there a good reason?
And powerful,
if the fellow's rushing at you with a dagger, maybe.
Powerful people you treat just the same as the non-powerful people.
I hope so. I'm not very interested in people's power. I'm interested in who they are.
What do you find most interesting in people?
Look, everybody's on some kind of quest. People whose quest is pronounced, I suppose, are the most interesting people. That can be a sociopolitical quest. It can be a personal quest. People who are trying to do something go somewhere. People in whom that is a pronounced phenomenon, I suppose, are the most interesting people. I never particularly thought of that. I've never thought of the question, never mind the answer.
No, I like the quest there. Thing makes sense to me. What about money? Because in journalism, there's not a huge amount of money. In law, you could have made a whole lot more. Why did you make that decision? Is money a big deal to you?
No. In fact, this is a sore point now. I mean, I just told you I spent an enormous amount of time trying to do this other thing. The intention was take a little bit of time out of earnings in order to get this thing sorted, but then it just got overblown. I do a fair amount of odd jobs. I do a column in The Star these days, which is, what the hell, there's still newspapers and they still
offering
columns. I do that. Yeah. And other odd jobs. I do some teaching jobs and mediation jobs. Mediation is a wonderful industry. It's a wonderful, unutilized, under-recognized, underutilized and under-recognized
industry. Is this
industry.
Like what the CCMA do?
Yes.
You get people into a room and they've got a dispute, and instead of them having to go to court or having to have someone else decide for them, the mediator is a very skilled person who's able to bring them together.
Let me say yes to that, and let me also say that there's different kinds of mediation. Frequently, you have a quarrel with Mabali, and you want to pay 50 rand and she wants 100. And frequently mediation says we'll make it 75. There's also times that mediation can go really amazing places. There's also times that you can have hard, tough differences that can resolve in a way that is better for both parties than your legal process would have been for either party. Now, that's where mediation is truly exciting. It's really great. I've had one particular experience of that and some others that have come sort of close. But mediation can be wonderful. You can, through that process, not only can you come to results that way exceed what you'd originally sought, but you can do it so rapidly, so easily, and at such minimal cost. There's times that a thing that would take years to come to court, weeks in court, years more waiting for judgment. There's times that you can start at 8 and you go home at 5 and you've got an agreement and signed.
Don't you think that there are places that this whole country could do with some mediation?
Absolutely, absolutely.
I mean, wouldn't it be great to kind of have a post-CODESA-CODESA, where we can just evaluate where we are and what we still need to do. And we could have a mediator, even a group of people mediating, who could just help us figure out the way forward. There's such a leadership crisis going
on. Supposedly, this is what we have Parliament for.
Yeah, well, come on. Parliament, what do you think of Parliament right now?
Well,
I mean, you hear it, you got some interesting things going on. Don't tell me Parliament's ever been as exciting as it is now. Maybe the day Favut got stabbed.
No, that just happened there, Dan. What's happening now, I don't really think is... I think that there can be better uses of Parliament. I'd like to see Parliament as a more central entity in a place where there was... Okay, I suppose all parliaments are vulnerable to becoming echo chambers of party debate, party policies, party lines. In ours is now. Okay, I'm kind of waffling here now because I don't really know what the answer is to the question. Come to a different question, the secret ballot thing.
Okay, let's talk about
that. I want to say I don't think the secret ballot is a good idea. I don't think it's right.
This is a very strange opinion. I didn't expect this from you. Why?
Okay, for one thing, I just think it's wrong in principle to invite and encourage people who are supposed to be 400 people, they're meant to be at the very apex of our society, the most leading people, to encourage them to furtively lie is bad news. And the whole object of the secret ballot is to able people, ANC people, to say, kick Zuma out, and then knowing perfectly well that they're then to turn to the party and say, well, of course I voted for Zuma. The idea is to enable people to lie. To me, that's
it's
morally wrong to start with.
Duplicity.
Yes, encouraging duplicity. Right. Beyond that, it's the notion that people who've been appointed because of their political views, the notion that they should be able to then express those views unbeknown to those who appointed them, which in this case is not an individual constituent, but the electors of the ANC. To me, that's just out of court morally. We voters correctly have a secret ballot. Nobody needs to know. We haven't offered ourselves as politicians. When a person has been voted for, when he's been elected to a position of power by people who, in this case, have said, we believe in the ANC and you're there to reflect our belief in the ANC, you can't turn around and say, well, I vote secretly, I won't tell you what I'm doing. It's wrong.
You owe us that. You owe us that explanation then, as voters.
We are entitled to know what your mind is doing. Plus, to me, the proper way out of this would be to push not for a secret ballot, but to push for a no-whip ballot.
Mm-hmm.
The whips can withdraw. You can have this. That can mean two things: withdrawing the whip. In this sense, I'm saying that when the whips agree, when the party agrees that you can vote your conscience, that's a really rational way of voting.
Absolutely.
Now everybody says no, but then the guys who wanted to vote against Zuma would be too terrified to do that. Well, why would not the guys who would not want to vote for Zuma be precisely equally terrified that if the result is in favor of
getting rid of him,
they are the ones who are going to be penalized?
Have you ever thought about politics? I mean, you must have been told by many people through the course of your career, oh, please go into politics. You know, whenever you have an opinion about something, you tend to be a lightning rod.
I have. In 1994, there were people who were saying that. They were saying that to me, and they were saying that to John Quelani.
Mm.
Quelani. Mm-hmm. Quelani. Mm-hmm. Quelani. Kwelani. That's better.
There we go. Finally, it's clicked in.
Do it again. Brag a bit.
What was
that? Sheesh. That's been my party trick, damn. You stole it.
All right, so you and JQ.
And people had said, come, do it. And the day before, the day that the ballots had to be in, the entries or nominations had to be in, applications, whatever, by midnight, there was this gathering at a house in Brixton. And I remember the house now, and I remember the Amstel. For some reason, we had like hundreds of Amstels. And the idea was that John and I were going to be joint leaders of this party, for which we actually had a name.
Really?
Yeah. And the name was sort of semi-cheeky. It was cheeky. It was quite nice. It might come back to me just now. Anyway, step one, John didn't pitch. Well, hey, that was a bit of a kind of a squelcher. Step two, we then thought, well, maybe we're going to amend it. And I correctly said no. And there was lots of guys who were urging, do it. And I correctly said no, and I'm damn glad I did.
Do you still think that... That people are as interested in reading opinion as they have ever been? Or do you think that because of things like Twitter, which is just as... Are you on Twitter?
I sort of am. I've got a lovely handle, Den Quixote. But I haven't used it much. Vachabiki, Gareth, because this one comes up, this thing that I've been doing, I'm going to be using Twitter a whole damn lot.
All right, so then we must follow you.
Well, hopefully
Den,
you will, yes.
Den Quixote, you're going to have to...
I will send to you or whatever. I'll
We've tweeted you, so yes.
Oh, okay.
Are you looking at causing trouble? Are you looking at making a noise?
Yeah, I'm certainly looking at making a noise. I want this thing now. I want it to be established that there is an option.
Explain it. It's very mysterious the way you...
It's okay. For present brief purposes, let me just repeat what I've said. There's a wasted source, the wasted resource of society.
These
is the people, the alleged doffies and thickos who can't bring themselves to vote. I'm extremely sympathetic with the fact that those guys don't see anything to vote for.
These are non-participants in
not only non-participants, but also quite a number of participants who only go to cast, to put their name against the parties they were born into.
Yes.
Parties are semi-religions. Here.
Yes.
You're born into a party and your grandfather's going to turn in his grave if you defect. Mm. And so you just stay there forever. Most people do. Most people only ever in their lives vote for one party.
Yeah.
And that's not bad. If they want to, that's absolutely fine. There's no objection to that. All that I'm saying is if people were presented with a full, rich way of expressing things that they want, including things that they don't think are political, including things that they think is just life. I've quoted the story of the dustbins. It might be that one party in your area is standing for the dam and another party is standing for the road.
So what are you saying here? You're gonna mobilize these people?
Yes.
This is going to be a vehicle for so ironically, you end up in politics.
No. Well, I certainly don't end up as a political party.
You're an influencer.
I'm saying there's a way of making politics work. A system of politics. We've been built...
Are you going to design the system and share it with us?
Yes, absolutely. That's what is in the...
Okay.
Not the detail, but the broad principle.
When are we... What's the ETA on
this? Imminent. Now, I will admit that I've used this word imminent a few times in the past, but now it's genuinely, really... If I wasn't going away for this weekend, I do believe that I'd have it to some... A bunch of young guys have set up a site for me, which I've been very bad on sites and stuff. I've had sites, but they all fall apart because I haven't watched them. But a bunch of young guys have set up the site, and they're waiting for this latest bit, and I was going to give it to them on Monday, but now I'm slightly delayed. But that's close. But just let me say one more thing on that. The history of mankind, the political history of mankind, has been a move away from the power of the strong towards the power of the many. That's easy. We can accept that. It's been happening all along. We now tend to think, well, we've got there. We've got to the point where everybody has a vote, in most countries in the world, technically at least, even if not in reality. Everybody is equal. Everybody has, theoretically has his vote. So we think we've made it. That's the end. And in fact, Francis Fukuyama famously wrote a book saying, you know, this is the end of it now. And from here on, it's tidying up. I'm saying, no, it's not the end. We're only halfway. We're maybe not even halfway up that little mountain. The next one is where the vote is a meaningful vote. Your vote at the moment is not meaningful. You're told you rule. You're the people, huh? You, me, see you here, Ben. We're told we rule. What do we rule? We don't rule a damn thing. How would you go about using your power of citizenship to have a speed bump erected outside your gate? How would you do that? I think the short answer is you wouldn't. You would have to shriek and yell and shout and
burn something.
Yep. And so I'm saying the next step is that the hollow vote that we have now is a real vote. It's a real vote that is, because of its use, is sufficient to attract some people, sometimes, who would never have voted in this current system, to put them to use, making them a force against which, making politicians scared of their voters is what I'm getting at. There's no politician right now who's scared of you. There might be people who are scared of you in the million or millions of people that you might represent, but there's nobody that you can go to and say, I, Gareth, say that unless you do X, I'm going to take my vote away from you. There's nobody who's going to say, I better do X.
But that's
we're going to laugh at you.
That's because they're not accountable to you. They're accountable to the party.
Okay, so we're getting there. Make people accountable.
If what I'm understanding from this is correct, this is kind of, and I don't mean to be glib here, this could be a magnum opus for you. This could be the...
I've been 18 years on it, after all, if you consolidate, over 33 years. Damn, it ought to be pretty magnum by this stage. Incidentally, part of the thing about magnum is that it's very mini. This is precisely the issue that has delayed me on this now, is to make it... I'm trying to say it in half an hour of reading. I'm trying to say...
Okay.
I don't want a million-word book here. It would have been relatively easy to write a million-word book. I want to now say it in like 5,000 words. This is a picture that I hope you can follow.
Viva.
Viva.
It sounds like something we should
Viva
all...
Cliff Central. There we are.
It sounds like something we should all get behind.
Good.
Well, Dennis, I could sit and talk to you for hours and hours. It feels like 5 minutes, but it's been an hour almost. And we've got to wrap it up here. We've got Frankly Speaking coming up next with Andrew Levy and Rory Chabalala.
Oh, that's rather nice. Good. Yeah,
you know them.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm sorry about
they're
that.
There. Yes. Hey!
Dennis Beckett, it's a pleasure to see you again. It's been terrific catching up. I hope that the next time we speak to you won't be another 18 years.
I'm all in favor of that.
Yeah,
thank you.
That would be nice.
When the magnum mini opus is around,
come and tell us first.
Maybe I'd like you to read it, and if it makes you want to discuss,
I would like that
very
much.
Happily discuss.
Thank you. See ya?
Thank you.
I promised you he would be interesting, and I'm sure he's over-delivered, right?
Listen, I've just been soaking every single minute of this up, so thank you very much.
All right,
Dennis Beckett, everybody. CliffCentral.com.